You know the old saying, wherever you go, there you are. It's one of those deceptively simple adages, the kind that sounds obvious until life slowly proves otherwise. The longer I've lived with it, the more I've come to believe that there are certain times and certain places where a person is just a little more where they are. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. In my life, there's been one place above all others that has marked my adult years. It's a place that has been as constant as the calendar itself. And next week, as the calendar turns, after more than 40 years, that place is closing. Café Central sits in the Plaza del Ángel in Madrid, just steps from the Puerta del Sol. That's kilometer zero, like ground zero. It's the symbolic center, not only of Madrid, but of the country. It's the point from which all roads in Spain are measured and to which they all, in some sense, return. Cultural life in Madrid happens in public. For generations, cafes served as informal salons, places for conversation, politics, chess, poetry, and late-night reflection. And the Café Central came from that tradition. It was opened in the early 1980s during Spain's cultural reawakening after nearly 40 years of dictatorship under Francisco Franco. It was started by a group of young idealists. It was run from the beginning by committee, which meant it was never really supposed to make money, I guess. In fact, it kind of seemed like it was designed not to make money. They had this great old-school booking policy. Bands were booked a week at a time, 7 nights in a row. So there were, at most, 52 possible acts who could play there every year. But in reality, it was fewer because some repeated. They came back multiple times each year. So there was a sense of exclusivity about playing there. The money was never very good. The club booker was famously gruff. And yet, just to be invited felt like a kind of victory. My own story with the place began in 1997, when I was a 20-year-old exchange student living in Seville. I skipped class one day and took a train to Madrid, walked into the club just as they were opening, and sat at the bar for 12 hours straight, from afternoon coffee to late-night wine, watching a band set up, rehearse, and then perform. And I fell in love that day with the place, with an idea, with a dream, with a feeling. Whatever it was, I walked out to a phone booth in front of the club that night and I called my dad, Ben, in Wisconsin, who, as you may know, is a jazz musician. And I told him that I had found the place he needed to play in Madrid. That phone booth, it turns out, would come to symbolize so much for me. When my dad came to visit me in Spain a few months later, we went to meet with the booker of the Café Central, Gerardo, to try to get a gig. And Gerardo listened politely and then said simply, "I don't think your music will work in my club." And with that, we were locked out. But a twist of fate not long after that changed his mind, and we were eventually offered a week the following November. From that point on, in 1998, the club stopped being something I chased, and it became something we returned to year after year, a ritual. Over time, ritual became tradition, and tradition became legacy. Every November, one week at a time, then two. Albums came and went, lineups shifted, soloists rotated, but the calendar held until ultimately we spent hundreds of nights there over the course of nearly 30 years, up until this year. At the end of our two-week run back in 2006, which is already 20 years ago, Gerardo pulled me aside and told me that the following year would mark our 100th performance at the Café Central. And Ben and I talked about it and decided we should record it. That's how our album Cien Noches came to happen, as a document of our duration.
We are so happy to be here in the Café Central tonight. Our 100th night, más o menos, the Café Central. You know, Americans love Europe. We find it so quaint. We love the fact that you have kings and queens. We think that's cute. The Crusades, charming.
Café Central is not a place you would design on purpose as a jazz club. It's bright and exposed. There are floor-to-ceiling windows that face the street. Passers-by can see straight in. Nothing is hidden, It has high ceilings and columns that block the sight lines. But it is full of feeling. It's a soulful space where magic can happen. And so it became one of the most important jazz rooms in Europe. But now, on January 1st, after years of fighting to stay open, nearly closing, changing owners, surviving, the Café Central will pull down the gate one final time. At least, that's what they say. So, to close out this year of Third Story Podcasts, once again, I talked to my parents about this experience. Last week, my dad and I honored our friend, the late Phil Upchurch. This week, we consider the legacy of the Café Central. What I thought we should do is just kind of reflect on the place, what it meant to us.
It's difficult to talk directly about the experience. You sort of have to talk around it, kind of like with a rhetorical side eye, about what makes a place what it is. I mean, you can describe the Café Central physically, you know, mirrors everywhere so that the pillars were not an obstacle. And of course, when we started playing there, everybody was still smoking. First of all, it was difficult to get on the stage. The audience was right there. The sound system was problematic. But when you walked in the room, there was something very engaging about the place. It was a place you wanted to be in. There are legendary jazz clubs. Let's just start here. One of them is the Village Vanguard, for example. Another one would have been Birdland in New York. What made those places legendary? Well, obviously, the musicians and the music, but more than that, they became known as the places where the music lived. And it's the same thing with the Café Central. You walked in there was something deceptively comfortable about the place. And I think that's a key, because when you go to a jazz club, this is, again, in the historical nature of what a jazz club was. And as Art Blakey said, you go to wash away the dust of everyday life. You don't just go to have a trivial experience. In jazz clubs, you want to walk out a little different than when you walked in. The experience should be transformative so that, again, it becomes part of how we remember the evenings, the experience. It's part of our social engagement with our fellow man. You know, this is a high calling. And this is another place without a dressing room. Well, later on they got one. But at the time, there's no dressing room. You come off the stage, you got nowhere to go. You're in the pool. You mix with the people. People were very nice. People were digging it. They were friendly. The wait staff, the people at the Central, they loved it. They loved the fact that we came and made music that felt good. So what I remember is climbing up on the stage, because there was no easy way to get there. You had to walk through the house, ask people, excuse me, can I, thank you. It was not a space you would walk into and think this will make a good jazz club. But yet, see, this is, I guess, my point about memory and jazz clubs. What you remember is how it felt in the room. You don't necessarily remember the microphone stands were broken down. All of this was put together, not by intention, but by a lack of an alternative. This, again, often turns out to be the most creative circumstances, when you don't have all the resources you need, when it's not about how much money is being spent and all this stuff, you come up with creative solutions. And the Central was just a very fortunate gathering of creative solutions. And the feeling when you walked into the place was that you were welcome. I mean, don't you think that all these things contributed to an intimacy that allowed me to dig into the performance aspect of what I wanted to talk about?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it succeeded not in spite of its limitations, but because of its limitations.
There it is.
The first time that we played at the Café Central was to present a project called the Concert for García Lorca, a tribute to the Spanish poet and playwright Federico García Lorca. It was actually a kind of accidental record, a concert that was recorded without our knowledge, but we loved the sound of the recording so much, we ended up releasing it, and it changed the course of our family for years.
Maybe we should talk for a minute about that Lorca experience, because that really set us off on a path. The fact that the first year that we went to Spain, we were in Granada, we fell in with Federico Garcia Lorca's niece. Through her, we wound up playing at a concert in celebration of Lorca's 100th birthday. We eventually put it out, released it as a CD. Suddenly, we were attached to the legacy of Lorca.
It's my great privilege and pleasure to be here tonight. You all know the story, but maybe in the telling, we can help to get it right.
People didn't know much about you, but one of the first things they learned about you. Oh, Ben Sidran, American jazz musician, has made a tribute to Garcia Lorca.
Well, and vice versa. I didn't know a lot about them, but Lorca gave me a way in. And reading his poetry and reading his essays gave me a way in.
And you walked in to Spain telling people about Spain.
I know. Well, forest for the trees. I mean, sometimes that's exactly correct. You know, somebody from outside can reflect back on you something that you just have assumed is normal for so long you don't even see it.
Lorca said, a dead man in Spain is more alive as a dead man than any place else in the world. And it's true. In Spain, one is not truly living unless one is truly dying. It's part of what that great philosopher Miguel de Unamuno called the tragic sense of life. You know this. Unamuno wrote, to act in such a way as to make our annihilation an injustice, in such a way as to make our brothers, our sons, and our brothers' sons, and their daughters, feel that we ought not to have died. This is the way to perform our occupation passionately, tragically, if you like. This is the way we are impelled to stamp others with our seal, to perpetuate ourselves in them and in their children. This is the way. This is the way we defeat death. This is the way death is defeated.
Playing for 7 or 14 nights in a row does something to the music. Over time, the notes start to breathe. The spaces between them matter, and the city enters the music quietly. Between sets, over long lunches, during afternoon walks. It's not just about what happens on stage, it's about what happens around it. But playing in the same club for 10, 20, almost 30 years in a row does something to the music too.
How do you think a place teaches you to play differently?
The audience, how the audience reacts. I mean, we go in there, we go into any room, and we throw out the first song, sort of like throwing out chum into the waters to see what comes up and bites it. And for me, the audience leads me through the set in a way. You know that. It's one of the reasons why I tend not to have set lists, because I wanted the experience to lead me. You can hear it on the Cien Noches album, on some of the songs where I'm starting to play a groove, and you can just feel the audience rising to the music.
Last night we had a bunch of people in here dancing.
They didn't need permission to participate.
People say, now wait a minute, I thought this was supposed to be a jazz club.
They knew. I mean, people were dancing.
That's right.
I think that's another thing we should not forget.
If you had been up in Harlem in 1927 in the jazz club, you would have seen some people dancing.
Jazz, historically, people dance to it.
And if you were up here last night, you would have seen some people dance.
Now it's all intellectualized.
This music is made for dance.
But we showed up and we played music that was sophisticated.
Every jazz musician from Ornette Coleman to John Coltrane to Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Charlie Parker played for dancing.
Man, there were people dancing.
Played for dancing.
Cafe Central didn't have any problem with
now,
that.
Now, rhythm is a hypnotic thing. It's like hypnosis. And it certainly precedes language. I'm talking 100,000 years ago. It's probably the start of all religion. People getting together around a fire 100,000 years ago and grooving. Something magic happens when the groove enters the room. In the sanctified church, they call it calling the spirit down. Calling the spirit down. Here in Spain, we like to think it's bringing the spirit up from the ground. Because in Spain, the spirit, also known as the duende, comes up out of the ground. We got that from Garcia Lorca, who told us, the duende does not come from up above. It's not like a little angel who visits you from time to time, descending with its love. The duende comes from the ground. So, when you think with your feet instead of your head, it's always more profound, whether it's never said.
Again, we're talking around and around an extraordinary venue that didn't set out to be an extraordinary venue, which is part of what made it extraordinary.
To go back to the same room for nearly 30 years, how are you transformed?
It made me more comfortable to be myself in public. Every time we went there, sometimes 14 nights in a row, I was able to settle in. I was able to dig into the music. I was able to see how my behavior on stage affected the people in the audience.
And I think it also was a mirror that was held up to you. You know, I think it came at a time in your career when you were pretty sure you knew who you were and what you did. And here are a bunch of people that didn't know who you were, and they saw you for the first time. I mean, you got to be new in your mid-50s after 30 years of a career already, and see yourself reflected back quite literally in a room filled with mirrors. But also, what they took from you wasn't necessarily what you thought you were selling up until that moment.
On the other hand, an unusually large number of people came back year after year, some of them from as far away as Germany, because we would always come at the same time of year. It used to be November. We'd come in November. They would mark their calendars. I mean, initially, they might have stumbled into the room and found us, but then it became an ongoing ritual for them as well.
And they came to see Judy.
Yep.
My mother, Judy, almost always traveled with us. Later, my wife, Amanda, did too, and eventually even our daughter. So we weren't just a band, we were a small traveling tribe. I have tried for years to capture my mom on tape in a way that reflects her easy, natural manner. And recently, I had a kind of breakthrough. I discovered that the best way to get her is just to call her on the phone. Judy is so quietly crucial to so many of the stories that I've shared about my own life, and I think I inherited a lot of my personal curiosity, inquisitiveness, and social dexterity from her. But she is not a person who is comfortable having her picture taken, and she's not comfortable with a microphone in front of her either. These recorded phone calls have been a revelation. And so, without further ado, here's Judy.
We went back so many years in a row because we loved the vibe and we loved the environment and the looseness. And we just felt so part of a community and a neighborhood. It was great. And remember, before COVID, it was one thing. And after COVID, it was another.
Yeah.
The bulk of it was pre-COVID, where it was really crowded and there was great energy everywhere. There were chairs everywhere. The waiters could barely get through. They didn't serve a lot of food. So it wasn't all about waiters coming with plates of food. You know, they had cheese plates, a few plates. Then after COVID, it turned into more of a music and dinner.
Yeah.
And there was not much of a space for musicians. People were in the same space as musicians in the break and before and after. So it was very neighborhoody, community, everybody together, easy access to you guys, friends that grew over the years, and a great way to get together with people and meet and know that you were going to see comfortable. It was just really comfortable. It was our space. When you guys played there, you controlled the space and the kinds of people that came. It was just fun. That's why we went back so much. Staying for a week someplace really gives you a chance to settle in. You're not as tired from traveling. You get to blend in with the neighborhood. We started feeling like we were part of a neighborhood. We would go to the same laundry every year. I would bring the laundry in. They knew me from one year to the next. I mean, I sort of felt like they must have known we were traveling, but I sort of felt like they thought the restaurant 2 years, you just haven't been in a while, but you're still here. it was just welcoming and comfortable. We got our routine down. We started learning more restaurants. It was just always easy for us to stay in the same place and develop a routine. And it grew over the years, included more people, and people started coming with us because they heard it was so great and so much fun. Ben talked about Cafe Central. He used to say it was his favorite club anywhere. And it was just comfortable and easy. We became friendly with Gerardo, and he was happy when we came. We were happy that he was there.
We took him out for a steak dinner.
We always had a lunch with him, a wonderful lunch. And it was hard to communicate. You were the one that could communicate with him the best and the easiest. The rest of us, he flubbed through and we flubbed through, and yet we enjoyed each other. I mean, he even took us to Segovia by train, which is where he's from. He wanted us to go. By a bus we went to show us his town and eat the pig there that's so famous. Yeah, no, we had a great time. We became friendly with him. But going for a week at a time, it makes a huge difference that way, because you do get to be part of what's happening.
Yeah.
And blend in. And we were excited about it. We wanted to learn. We wanted to, you know, we felt we were in a very historic place. We felt like we were in a Spain of change. It was still, we still felt when we started going there that it was newly coming out of the Franco period, and it was just coming alive, an awakening. And we were there for part of that, and we could feel it. And now it's, you know, it's going like everywhere else in the world. It's growing quickly, and it's gentrifying, and the neighborhood's changing, and you hardly hear Spanish on the street anymore. It's just very quickly it's come into today's time.
Well, that's the thing, is I think that when we started going there, Madrid was not an obviously attractive place for some people. And a lot of friends, when they would go to Spain, they would say, oh, we love Barcelona. We didn't quite get Madrid. It was kind of hard at first to figure out where to eat and where to go. And there was no English at all, which was great for me. I loved it, but it was harder, you know, for you. And it was kind of provincial. Like it felt like we were, where are you going? You guys go to Madrid every year for 2 weeks?
Yeah. No, it was a leftover. It was still leftover. It wasn't up with the times yet, but it caught up with the times. Yeah. We were there for that period where it was growing. Yes, we have very fond memories. Cafe Central played an important role in our tour. It was an anchor of the tour. And then it went for 2 weeks. That was the time where I took the opportunity to take a break and go somewhere else for part of it, travel in Spain, or I went to Morocco, or use the extra time to go somewhere else. Because playing seven nights in a row for the wife of the musician is a lot. And not speaking Spanish, there wasn't a lot I could do in the evenings. Plus, I was alone. So I went to the club all the time, except if I took a night off and just stayed in the hotel.
What is it like for you to see us play 7 and 14 and 20 nights in a row and see the show over and over and over again? I mean, I remember.
Yeah, Bill McHenry's father came and he said to Bill, does she go every night? He says, yeah, she does. It's all different. I don't want to miss anything. I don't want to miss anybody who comes to see you that, you know, we only see once a year. The nice thing is it's not that long. A couple of sets for an hour. I know all the tunes. Sometimes the musicians change a little bit. It's fine. It's fun. I feel part of the team. It makes me feel part of the team by being there. And of course, I acquired the title of Road Mom, which I appreciated. And it wasn't a problem.
And then
there was the hang after the gig. You know, you never knew who was going to show up.
Jazz clubs are by definition bad business. Cafe Central may be the best example I know of a place that has been going out of business in the same location for over 40 years. In 2018, new owners, Willie and Jorge, took over the club. And the economics of the whole situation changed. The booking model shifted. The future arrived, whether or not anyone expected it.
We put in all those wonderful years, and we've been sad for the last number of years every time we hear that it's going to be closing, and grateful that it doesn't close, but clearly it's going through its time of change.
I was trying to remember exactly when, you know, Willie bought it, and it turns out it was in 2018. So
right before COVID.
Yeah, Gerardo sold it a couple of years before COVID, and so they had already started to make those changes. And, you know, one of the changes I think that they had already made was that they changed the audience, where rather than getting to stay all night the same audience would stay for both sets, they started to turn it into two shows.
Where right.
You did one show and then they changed the audience, you did another show. I think that was already happening, but that was one big change. And then COVID, they had to reduce the number of people they could fit in the club. So that was right. different
and,
too.
And the food, opening up the restaurant more, they made it more of a restaurant.
I remember the night I met Willie and his partner Jorge, who bought it, because we were there when November when they agreed to buy it. And I met him that night and he said to me, as soon as he agreed to buy it, he said, I'm looking at it with new eyes. For the first time I'm looking at it and I'm wondering, why are they serving this food on these plates, on these small tables, big plates on small tables? And why are they serving this kind of food? And he immediately started thinking about the kitchen. And he, you know, that was the first thing he wanted to do was change the menu.
He wanted to keep the club alive. And in order to keep the club alive, he had to make more money. Yeah. And he was figuring out ways to make more money. And having two different shows was one way to do it. And bringing in more food was another way to do it. I mean, he was smart. He was being a businessman. Of course, it changed it a bit. But we got the upstairs. We got used to the upstairs. So the band had a place to go in the break. And they were very generous about feeding the band and including me in feeding us. They were nice to us, very nice to us.
One of the first moves that the new owners made was to change the booking policy and mostly do away with week-long residencies. A couple of the legacy acts, like Ben, were still invited to play seven nights at a stretch. But for the most part, the Central began to run more like a standard venue, an act for a couple of nights at a time, and the room turned over each night between sets to effectively double the possible audience. It made all the business sense in the world, but it also marked a steady move into the inevitable future and away from a kind of illuminated past. And in a twist of timing that feels almost poetic now, that shift also opened the room to me in a new way. Without Gerardo's bebop gruffness as the final filter, and with a younger booker and a changing model, I began bringing my own band to the Central. And I've returned every year since then.
Let me ask you something, because you are clearly taken with this moment and with the transition in Madrid. Do you have a sense of what you're searching for in this question?
There is a part of me that feels that my connection in Madrid, my relationships there, my access there is a kind of secret superpower that I have. I am Clark Kent in my life, and I am Superman in Madrid. And the phone booth that I go into to change is the Cafe Central.
That's fantastic.
And they're taking my phone booth away.
That's it. There it is.
On the other hand, I think it's a moment of growing up for me. I don't believe that the place belongs to me any more than it belongs to anybody else. I do know that I came of age in that place, that I started out as a kid. I started out as being defined as somebody's son. And over the years, I have become myself as a drummer, then as an artist, as a performing musician, as an adult person. All the things that happened in my life, they happened with the Cafe Central kind of marking the passage of time for me. The fact that we went back at the same time every year for 25 years, the only other example I have in my life of something that I did like that was celebrating Rosh Hashanah at the Gates of Heaven in Madison. So it's like a religious thing for me. It's the same thing as going to synagogue.
I'm sitting here davening, listening to you.
Yeah,
man.
We turned that room out so many times with you. For 20 years, I went with you, and I saw you turn that room out year after year. And I saw you call the spirit down, and I saw you change people. And so when I went on stage for the first time as my own artist, not playing with you, but I walked on stage, and I thought, how am I going to do that to these people? And so I think I really learned how to get it together on stage by confronting that fact and facing that fact and facing that fear in that room.
Rumors of closure always persisted. But But I had stopped believing them long ago. I actually started to joke that the Café Central was like a cockroach that could not be exterminated. But in June of this year, sitting in the plaza after a show with friends from the club, we learned that this time it was apparently true. Café Central would close on October 12th. The rent was just getting too high to survive. The lease was up. There was no way around it. And I was actually invited back to play in September for a run of farewell concerts. As I prepped for those shows, I started to do the math. And when I added all of it up, I realized I had spent close to 9 months of my life on that stage. The amount of time it takes to gestate a human being. No wonder it felt like the place that had made me who I am. On that last night in September, I stood still on the stage, breathing in the room one last time. And I cried. But later that night, the staff told me that the lease had been extended yet again and the Café Central would survive a little longer.
The other thing that I'm just thinking about is the number of times that they said they were going to close and the number of times we thought maybe this was it and we're not going to be back next year. And then we were. And so it's sort of like, I know that they're closing, even though I also kind of think they might not be. Like, I'm sure that they are. And yet, as you know, I flew over there, Ben. I flew over there in September.
Yeah. Yeah.
And stood on stage and cried because they were closing. And then they walked off stage and they said, well, we're not really, not yet.
Tell me what's the weather in Madrid. It's cold in New York these days. The leaves begin to change. If you call me now to get away, I wouldn't have to hesitate. But shall I fall? Café Central. What I would do would give.
So did you consider that experience typically Spanish, by the way?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that because you referred to it in one of our back and forth emails as being typically Spanish. I suppose because I don't want it to sound in any way judgmental or something. But yes, I mean, that is a very, in my experience, a very Spanish experience to have really gone through the full emotional expression of something only to find that it was maybe not reflective of the reality.
Again, the Lorca. A dead man is more alive in Spain than a dead man anywhere else in the world.
Well, then the Café Central, should it close, will continue to be alive more than anywhere else.
There is a parable about three shoemakers. Unamuno tells it. The first shoemaker makes shoes to earn a living, and he makes good shoes. The second shoemaker, he's on a higher plane. He does it for the art, to make the best shoes he can possibly make. Ah, but the third shoemaker, he's on a higher plane still. He aspires to become, for his friends and his fellow man, the one and only shoemaker, indispensable and irreplaceable. The shoemaker who looks after them so well that they will feel a definite loss when he dies, when he is dead to them, not merely dead. And they will feel that he ought not to have died. And this will be because in working for them, he inspired them to contemplate the higher truths. He shod them for the love of them and for the love of God in them. He shod them religiously. And so he did. Federico García Lorca shod them religiously. He gave his people their walking shoes to the future. He brought the tragic sense of life into the 20th century.
I think sometimes the fear is that when things close, they become relegated exclusively to memory, and they just join that long trail of crumbs that's behind us. And does it make us feel somehow less alive or less important or less relevant, or our persona is somehow in jeopardy.
Yes, and maybe it also makes us feel more alive because we have the memory and the place lives on in us, and we contain the past within us and we pass it on. So yeah, maybe more and less. Maybe nothing is unique to itself. Maybe everything contains the opposite. Maybe the jazz club is a projection of a community's desires. Maybe the music itself is just a vehicle for people to experience this. Maybe this is what jazz is about.
It's hard to make the changes. We've been trying to hang on to the Café Central as we know and love it, but it's not the same. And yeah, we hope everything good. It's just the way it is, you know, between the location and the building. And there's nothing, they're trying, they're fighting hard. They were fighting hard to preserve it, but it might be a time thing. It was a time and a place, and that's changing.
I think it was interesting to hear Ben in terms of what he wouldn't say.
Oh, you know, how it was for him.
For him, for you.
Yeah. You know, he always had this fantasy that he was going to get old and be sitting in the square with the old Spanish men. And now the old Spanish men aren't there the way they were.
Yeah. He loved looking in the square at the old men on the bench.
In their little sweaters, and they met their friends. And there was a real characteristic of the older people in Spain. I don't know where those people go now when they get old. I mean, there are different kinds of people now that get, you know, we're getting old. We're not the stereotypical old people that we knew when we were young, you know, so it just changes. I mean, remember the opera had the restaurant next to the opera. We used to go there, and then that closed. We lost a lot. We lost the bakery on the square that we used to go to for coffee. Do you remember that?
Suiza.
We lost all the traditional places, started going.
Absolutely.
And Café Central is one of those that's tried to hold on.
It's the last one standing. I mean, even the Bullfighter Hotel across the street was bought and turned into something else. And by the way, I don't know if I told you, it's under construction again. It's being turned into something else.
You're kidding. Well, the rooms are tiny because Ken and Louise stayed there.
There's nothing left. The Café Central was the only thing that was left.
Soon we won't, you know, it'll all be different.
You know, we could talk about the Café Central as a jazz club, but I don't think it's just specifically a conversation about a jazz club. I think it's like really looking at the way these locally owned small community businesses try to survive and how they hang on and ultimately what happens to them.
I mean, they're fighting an uphill battle. They gain a year, they gain a year, they gain a year, but in the end, they're going to lose anyway, you know?
Now there's talk of reopening the Café Central nearby in a new location and carrying as much of the original room to the new place, just moving it all down the hill. Which raises the question, if you take the same instruments, the same tables and the same chairs, the same mirrors and the same people, and move them to a new address, is it the same place?
There's not a specific thing, but it exists. For example, the Village Vanguard in New York, it's in a basement. You have walked down a flight of stairs. But the place became so famous that at one point, a Japanese businessman wanted to buy the Vanguard and take it to Tokyo. Now it's a basement. It's a hole in the ground. How do you take a hole in the ground to Japan? Yet there was so much myth around the place that he felt maybe it was the paintings on the walls. But we all agree that moving the paintings on the walls wouldn't move the myth, wouldn't move the magic. Birdland in New York, back in the day, they had what they called the peanut gallery, the peanut section, which were some bleachers off to the side where underage people could, it was like roped off, could go and hear the music. They couldn't buy alcohol, but could hear the music. Well, that's not just strictly a business model to get the $10 for a Coca-Cola. That's to raise future jazz listeners. That's to share what's going on in the space with people of various intent. Those are two of the greatest jazz rooms that ever existed. And we can't really say why they were, except there was something social about them.
Is it true that wherever you go, there you are? Or are some places simply more of what they are than others? To be on the safe side, I have reserved a couple of nights in March with my band at the Café Central, in whatever form it might take at that time. It's possible it will be in a new location. It's possible it will be in the same location. It's possible it won't be anywhere at all. But for now, they're still taking reservations just in case. The third story is produced, edited, and hosted by me, Leo Sidran, and made in partnership with WBGO Studios. As we come to a close on this, my 11th year of the podcast, I would like to thank all of you who listen, who support on Patreon or Substack, and who share it with your friends. Making the third story is a labor of love, and it is a privilege to tell these stories and share these conversations with you. Also, a big thanks to all the incredible guests who joined me in conversation this year: Madison Cunningham, Theo Bleckman, Dodie, Vera Brandes, Jacob Jeffries, Leonor Watling, Stella Cole, Ben Sidran on multiple occasions, Mary Sweeney, Moses Petru, Joe Henry, Aaron, Natalia Lafourcade, Terry Lynn Carrington, Pablo, Suzanne Vega, Arturo O'Farrell, Max Pollock, Raul Midon, Stephen Merritt, Nels Klein, Jorge Drexler, Steven Greenberg, and Micaiah McCraven. And my apologies to those of you, you know who you are, who I spoke to for the podcast and have not yet had a chance to release our conversations. I cannot wait to share more of these stories and talks with you in 2026. And with that, I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.